Good evening, everyone. Let us know in the chat where you're coming from tonight for our Gene Technology Bill Exposed webinar 2.0, the question and answer session. Levin. Yeah, down the road. Tauranga Wairua. Oh, here we go. It's really starting to whiz by now. You can let us know in the chat. Have you already given your feedback? Have you done your submission? Or are you still waiting to do it and learn more from the session before you get your feedback done? Yep, done and sent through already. Oh, now look, I can already see some questions coming in the chat. Because they're going past really quickly, we've actually got a bunch of questions that have come through from last week's session, as well as through on the email and stuff like that this week, but we will be watching the chat as well to get any more. But if you've got something that's really important, maybe wait till the chat just sort of settles down a little bit and repost it so that we can see it because it's just whizzing past. So welcome everyone. We've got many, many hundreds of you in the house already. We'll just let you wait for a little bit longer before we go in to introduce our guests for the evening. Just while we're waiting, for those of you who missed last week's, it is up. It's on YouTube and our Rumble channel as well, so you can go back and have a look at that session from last week if you have missed it, because we won't cover everything that we talked about last week. We might touch on a few different points, but it's definitely worth going back and having a watch of that. There's been some great clips that the team has taken and put out through social media. Fantastic kind of things to share with people who might be interested in this issue and not understanding what the big deal is. So please go and have a look on our social media and see what you can
Except
find to share.
Instagram, where they shut us down.
Except that is news in the last couple of days. We are getting too close to the truth again. And just yesterday, was it Tane, that we got an alert from Instagram that they have shut down our RCR and VFF Instagram accounts, and all we've been sharing is this stuff, so it's crazy. Thankfully, we've still got the Facebook page and definitely still the X account, but we're fighting to get our
And
Instagram.
Telegram.
Yeah. All right. So, this is being recorded. It will go out again, just like usual, as a recording later in the next couple of days once the team has turned it around. So, if you have somebody who's missed it this evening, you can let them know that that will be happening. So, I'll hand over to you, Tane, if you'd like to introduce our guests for the evening.
Sure. So yeah, we've got four great guests for you all tonight. Dr. Guy Hatchard, who many of you are familiar with, international advocate for food safety and natural medicine, with insights from his work as a director at Genetic ID. John Carapiet, spokesman for GE Free Aotearoa, market researcher known for his work with the Royal Commission on Genetic Modification and Consumer Rights Advocacy. Jono Frew, a conventional farmer turned regenerative agriculture expert and founder of Natural Performance Limited and Quorum Sense. And finally, Jodie Brunning, a sociologist based in the Bay of Plenty of New Zealand. Jodie is a trustee of Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility.
Fabulous, thank you. And you've got myself, Alia Bland, one of the co-founders of RCR and contributor down the bottom there, Tane Webster. So it's a nice house of six of us on the screen this evening. And up to about, oh, just over 800 of you in the chat tonight. So that's really cool. Now I've got on my list here that I forgot to mention before when we were talking about censorship and things, Guy, just before that, we have got other sides of this story. So if you would like to find out what other people have said on this, go and have a look on RCR. We've had Judith Collins on. That was a total disaster for her, of an interview with Paul Brennan that went viral in all the wrong ways, which maybe resulted in some of the other news of this week. But Guy has been censored lately too from the fact checkers. It
Yeah,
seems that they don't, really don't want you talking about this, right, Guy?
Yeah, there's a Kiwi journalist, George Driver, who's somewhere down, I think, in Christchurch, and he works for the Australian Associated Press, and he is the designated fact checker for Facebook. And I was throttled this week on Facebook. I mean, I corresponded with him, but he took absolutely no notice at all of, so I think we're right back where we were in 2021, where the government is absolutely determined to push this through without debate.
It's not great. I mean, it sounds like this whole the fact checkers falling over is only happening in the States at the moment, so we'll wait in line for it to kick into gear here. Just before we kick off, I wanted to show you all how to find the page on our website in case you haven't seen it already. So if you take over and head on over to the RCR website, you'll see RCR 2.0 is coming soon. For those of you saying in the comments, when are we coming back? Soon is the answer. You have to keep an eye on your inbox. So you head down and you see our campaigns here, and you can click on the green one for the Gene Tech Gamble. And that's just loading. Can you see that page now where we are? Yep. So here we have our rejected reckless gene technology bill. This is a landing page. If you share it with friends and family, this is where they'll come. They can put their name and email address in to get the free action pack, including the link to the webinar from last week. There's some video clips there for sharing around and a bunch of information about the Gene Tech Bill. And once you've done that and you've jumped through to the next thing, you will get to this page, which is how to have your say on the gene technology bill. And for those of you who weren't here last week, this here is a little video that shows you how to actually go about giving your feedback through the online form that the government has there. So you can watch that. It's 3.3 and a half minutes long. And then here we have our template for the feedback. So it's divided into different categories, and it's quite comprehensive. So we're looking at the precautionary principle, the risks to farming and exports, bodily autonomy and public consent, weak oversight, overreach and sovereignty concerns, scientific and safety concerns, economic concerns. So there's a bunch of different things that can spur you on there, and you can add your own ideas to your feedback so that it makes it unique to you. That's the best thing that you can do. But if you've got, if you're limited for time, then just picking a section of this and putting it through into your feedback is better than not doing anything at all. And then there's the recommendation. So there's two boxes that you need to fill in on this particular feedback, and the second one, which is your recommendation, that's fairly straightforward. So just have a read of that there. As we go down, there is the webinar replay and also the poster that can be printed off full size as an A4 sheet, or you can actually print it off A5 as well. Oh, there you go, Tane's got it there. And that could work as more of a flyer size. The font will be fine. It's not too small if you print it in the smaller size. There's more videos and short shareables, as well as some memes down the bottom there that you can click on and save and then share on social media. So that's just a little quick thing about what the pack that people can get if you sign up for the resources kit. So let's get started. Last week we talked about several issues, including the biggest danger of the Gene Tech Bill, the impact on New Zealand's clean green reputation, economic and trade risks of deregulation, the ethical considerations and the precautionary principle, which is a big deal for a lot of us, consumer rights and food safety, farming, community perspectives, specific clauses in the Gene Tech Bill, and who stands to gain from the bill. Tonight we've got a whole bunch of questions. I mean, there were hundreds of them that came through from the chat last week, so we haven't obviously we're not able to ask all of them, but we've got a selection that span a whole range of areas. So we're going to make our way through those tonight, And the plan is that you're going to leave the session this evening with a better understanding of this bill and its impact so that you can be more informed when you give your feedback. So it's been a busy week, and we've had this cabinet reshuffle. There's been a one question that's come through about that, which is from Bruce, and he says, "I would like to hear the guests' comments on the cabinet reshuffle, which I view as very suspicious. Judith Collins had to take far too much flak for the gene tech bill, so they moved science sideways to Shane Retty, but still with the motive of trying to drive this gene tech bill through. So I've got your name down here, Guy, is to kick us off on this, but obviously everyone else can chime in afterwards if you'd like to let us know
Well,
your feedback, Guy."
thanks, Ali. I think Shane Retty's a yes man. He's been put in there. He's been told you're going to get this bill through come what may. And he's just not well known for responding to the population at large. That's how I see it. I don't see that Collins has got less power. I think Jody, you can comment and give us an idea of what kind of power Collins has got still.
Yes, the Attorney General is the, Minister for the GCSB, NZSIS. She's the Minister for Digitising Government. So she's also the Attorney General. So she's responsible for good law, which is deeply ironic when we look at this bill. And she was the Minister for Science. But if you all have heard today's news, there's been a complete reshuffle in science policy. There's going to be four big institutions. So all her work in science is done. So Retty, and I really do feel sorry for him. He's been left with the science work done. So she's ticking that off, and now she's becoming the Minister for Public Service. So if you start seeing the picture of what Collins' portfolios Collins is in charge of, I would perhaps suggest that she's got more power than Luxon.
That's pretty scary. Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
I don't think an Attorney General has ever had that many ministerial portfolios, and New Zealand's always been vulnerable to consolidation of power. And even RNZ's latest press release on this whole reshuffle said that it's very top heavy. So there's not very many ministers in cabinet for how many ministerial portfolios there are.
I think Simeon Brown in health too. You've got someone who is basically got an undergraduate degree in commerce, and he's been put in charge of health. It speaks volumes about what the government thinks about health.
I've got a little bit of a view on this. Maybe the guy's absolutely right. They've got to pass a bill. They want to pass this bill. They kind of going to be embarrassed if they don't pass something. And all I can say is it can't be this bill. The bill needs to be a completely different thing or look different, or just stick with the HasNow Act we've got and look at some reforms there that might help what they're trying to do. The HasNow Act is actually not that bad. It's served us very well. And this bill is very bad. And to be honest, I do feel sorry for Retty too. To some extent, of course, these people are individually powerful, but I can't forget the old TV series, Yes Minister, where ministers are being run by industry and other people.
Yes, I remember that one from my childhood too. Very much so. Just popping over to this, there was some commentary this week that was critical of this bill in sort of fairly mainstream media, the Farmers Weekly, that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has concerns about the GMO trade implications. I'll just show you that one quickly, so that you can, we'll put the link to this in the chat as well so that you can share it if you so desire. So they have concerns about the GMO trade implications, and so it's quite good to see that kind of that coverage happening here.
And it didn't surprise me when I saw this. They should be really concerned. I mean, we have to be reliant on our exports. And if the overseas markets don't want what we're about to be pushed into, I think anybody at MFAT would be concerned.
And what I think is really interesting is Professor Jack Heineman's submission to this gene technology bill. I'm not sure if it's up online yet. So you go to Professor Jack Heineman at University of Canterbury and you look in his archives for a link to that. He was discussing the fact that the Ministry for Business, Innovation and Employment is emphasizing that all the countries that where they are deregulated, and they're even as Guy was pointing out last week, very disingenuously bringing in the Europe to that which they shouldn't be. But Professor Heineman is pointing out the fact, he's asking us to question who are our top trading partners and what are their regulations? Are their regulations as weak as us? And many of them, they're not. So we've got this problem where we've got all this deregulated technology. And of course, not all of it will be in food, but a lot of it will be in food and some will be in fiber. And so we are pretending that they can't run a screen, do a molecular characterization of the food and recognize that there's gene edited food in there. So we're weakening this and farmers are going to suffer for that.
Absolutely. That was my job at Genetic ID. It was just going through a mass of international barriers to GMOs. And big companies like ADM and Cargill had to test everything. They just had to certify it was GMO free. That still exists all over the world.
I think the worry from industry and this week, as well as what earlier mentioned, there was a story about the fact that the big food producer bodies like beef and lamb had actually asked for more time to submit on this bill because they've been a bit shocked. And if I was them, I'd also be shocked because what this bill does, because it exempts these what they call in Britain, the precision breeding techniques or new genomic techniques, but because it actually exempts them entirely if the company decides they look a bit like nature, so therefore they're going to be safe. That's a huge problem for traceability. And one of the things that we can be absolutely sure in New Zealand is that our ability to trace and track different kinds of food products and actually and pull them from the market if something goes wrong is a key asset for the integrity of our food supply and people's trust and confidence in it. So if I was the beef and lamb and dairy people, if I was being told by this bill, you're not going to have any traceability or visibility of these products, I'd be absolutely panicked. And I think that's why they wanted more time.
Yes, and so they've been denied that time, right? That's what the headline was saying. They've been told no.
I believe our members of parliament need to be informed about this by very many people, that the major industries, particularly the agricultural industries, aren't getting an extension. That I think they've turned around, they've had a look at the bill and they've recognised how terrible it is. But it took time. And Collins is very disingenuous. She knew this would be in place over the summer recess. That doesn't just mean people are on holiday. That means we cannot get our members of parliament in parliament to ask tricky questions very quickly to find out lots of answers. So it's been an evasive process in many ways.
Thank you. Thanks you both of you for that. We've also had, this is for Tane actually. Tane, we were going to be talking about Luxon today.
Yeah, so this one's for Jono initially, but Luxon had a speech today, State of the Nation, and in it there was a section about farming and this gene technology, and I'll just share a quote with you and then get your thoughts on it. But he says, "I also want New Zealand scientists working on high-yield crop variants and solutions to agricultural emissions that don't drive farmers off their land and risk the very foundation of the New Zealand economy. Enabling gene technology is about backing farmers. It is about embracing growth." Now, there's a bit before and after that, but that's the key part. I just thought should share that and get your thoughts on it, Jono.
Yeah, well, firstly, it's very rare that a variant of a breed of seed actually dictates yield. Most of the time, it's to do with environmental conditions, soil health, various things which we could go into depth with. I don't imagine it's the right audience tonight, but if he's talking about supporting farmers, New Zealand farmers are pretty damn good at what they do with the tools they've already got. And farmers themselves aren't going to benefit. I don't see any problems that any potential, even if you look at the people that are talking great possibilities from the stuff, I don't see even most of those are to me somewhat empty promises. But even those far-fetched solutions or technologies that they're pushing, we don't actually have the problems for them yet. So if I was Luxton and I wanted to back farmers, he said something about having farmers spend more time milking cows and filling out paperwork. Well, my suggestion there would be to get out on the ground, actually talk to farmers, get in their world, and just get out of the way. Like, we don't need this is going to create more headaches than for farmers than I would suggest a lot of the regulatory issues that farmers are dealing with at the moment, and that's a lot.
It's a bit of a pill for every ill. So if you look at drought tolerance, dozens, if not hundreds, of genes are involved. For example, with wheat, I think there's about 200 genes perhaps involved in drought tolerance. All the climate change stuff is saying there's going to be a medicine that we're going to give, cows, and that's going to fix everything. They're not putting funding in to improving drought funding, knowledge, soil management. They're pretending there's going to be some magical gene. It's ridiculous.
So get this, at the moment, if you're a conventional farmer that's been to conventional university, the way in which we will grow wheat is a monoculture, which never happens in nature. You never see a monoculture ever anywhere, one plant growing on its own. We treat it like a infant child. We do everything for it. We apply the nutrients we think it needs on the surface. We apply the water we think it needs on the surface based on more research done mostly in controlled environments where there aren't this ability for plants to interact with nature. Most of what creates drought susceptibility is the shallow-rooted nature of these plants resulting from our interference, basically. If you let plants grow naturally, if you don't interfere with like shallow, frequent watering, high analysis fertilizer on the soil surface, literally having roots come up to the soil surface instead of growing down. And not dealing with soil compaction, and in other words, dealing with hydrophobic soils, well, drought's going to be just a byproduct of that environment. No mucking around with genes is going to make a difference.
And one of the things coming from a kind of brand and marketing kind of view, I don't know whether the farmers know they've got what the world wants in terms of exports, because the market for non-GMO is huge and growing. And I constantly email Chris Luxon to say, look at the data, mate, look at the graphs, look at what's happening in India and China, even in America, where non-GMO is growing 10, 12, 13% a year. And so farmers have got this and they're exporting it, and they're not gonna, and not, I mean, you meet farmers, not many that say, yeah, I want GMO, but the ones who do don't realize that they've already got what consumers want, and they can make it better, but going the GE way isn't going to help them appeal to consumers. And it's not just about safety, it's a kind of a bit about kind of like taste, if you want. And I don't mean literally the taste, but it's about provenance and process and where food came from, including brand New Zealand, but also like free range. All of these things that are really important to consumers are kind of being, by this bill and the government and MBIE's attitude, is to say, well, it doesn't matter about the process, but we know people do care about the process. That's what we market on. So to say we're not going to regulate gene editing and it's just going to be the end product of it, and it's going to be proven safe, is missing the point.
If you think of, and what we're really talking about tonight, just to back up your point, John, is we're really speaking to the kind of commodity market, export market right now, which is great. We can it's our biggest export, and if we want to introduce things like, for instance, right now there's organic markets, there's non-organic markets. You can have an organic farmer here and a conventional farmer here chasing commodities, and they can do that, beside each other quite fine, as long as you're not spraying Roundup in a Norwest and your organic farmers on the south side. But if you introduce a technology that can blow in the wind and infect an entire farm and its certification for an organic market, well, that's not very fair. But then the other part of this is, even forget the whole commodity market thing, what about people like we farm here on 2,500 hectares? We definitely have an element of you know, commodity. We're producing a lot of beef and we're supporting dairy cows in the winter. And us ourselves, we're going dairy farming 1st of June, supplying Fonterra. So we know all about the commodity markets, but we also grow all of our own food in our massive vegetable garden, in our greenhouse, and we do a lot of hunting. That is we're not just risking our markets here, we're risking those people like us who want to support our families by growing food that we know the whole history of is all at risk with this technology.
You bring up an interesting point there, Jono, because which we haven't really talked about in the last webinar, the hunting in New Zealand is a great source of wild, high-quality protein that a lot of people like. And yeah, what's to say if this stuff starts to spread around into the conservation areas, into the hills, whatever, suddenly your wild shot venison's kind of not the same as it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I heard someone say we can make possum sterile. Well, where is that? Where's that happening already? These are all just fictional, made up woo woo ideas.
No fairy tale to sell the story. All right, shall we move on to some of the additional questions that we had from last week?
Yeah.
So I've got the first couple that have that I'll put together is from Andy and John. So Andy says, what problem is this bill trying to solve? Is there an actual problem to address, Guy? And John asked in the same sort of vein, is there an upside of the gene tech bill and why are they doing it? So who would like to have a go first? Is it Guy or John?
Yeah.
Your name's next to that.
I've had a number of people contact me in the last week or two, really sort of wondering, is there something here that is going to really benefit us, you know, some protein discovered or some cure discovered and so on and so forth. And, you know, my answer to your question is there are lots and lots and lots of problems that need solving. But unfortunately, gene technology is not going to solve them. It's going to make them worse. And there are very scientific reasons for that. You know, humans have around 20,000 genes, but 750,000, 750,000 distinct proteins. So one gene doesn't produce one protein. Genes are multitasking. So that means if you replace a gene in the hope that you're going to get rid of a problem with a protein, you're going to get all kinds of other changes in the physiology that come along. And adverse off-target effects are inevitable. You know, genes are not little mechanical blocks. This is a living organism. I don't know whether any of you, I'm sure some of you have, had serious operations. When you have a serious operation, you realize what a living organism you are. It sort of disturbs, it makes your physiology almost nervous because we're dealing with things, not mechanical blocks, but they're alive. And it's tremendously important for an organism to protect the integrity of its DNA. A quarter of transplant recipients, for example, develop cancer. And CRISPR gene editing, the so-called precise gene editing that everyone is talking about, is so disruptive that our immune system, when a person goes through a CRISPR editing procedure on a cell or cells, our immune system fails to repair the associated double strand breaks in the DNA. Now, that's something that our DNA, our cells, do tens of thousands of times every day in every cell. But if you get one double strand break, something totally ordinary in the physiology, as you do with CRISPR, they can't, the cell just simply struggles to repair it and makes a kind of poor job of it. The other thing I want to say is that these so-called miracle cures absolutely do not exist. A program to treat cystic fibrosis with gene therapy, which you might have read in the papers, was tremendously successful. Well, so far, there have been 22 people who've had the procedure. It costs $5 million per person. And 77%, that's more than three quarters of these people, had no residual benefits after 1 year. Can you imagine spending $5 million on something which fails within the first year? You'd want your money back, wouldn't you? Another thing that Collins told us about, CAT T cell treatment for cancer, costs $850,000 per shot. Usually puts cancer patients into initial remission, but in 50% or half of those patients, the cancer reoccurs sometime in the first year. The side effects are severe, can be life-threatening. Now, I want to point out, this is a poor outcome compared to traditional cancer treatments which we already use. So I think that I've given a long answer to this, Bill, to this question, but I think it deserves it. There's not something here. There's not a miracle that is waiting to happen. This technology is not working, and we've just lived through 5 years of gene technology, and cancers are on the rise. Up 50% bowel cancer incidence for working age people in the UK, up 11% across the board cancers in Sweden. Here in New Zealand, the government hasn't published cancer figures since 2020. Why? They used to publish them every year.
And still no one's talking about real health. Like, we've got all these ministers, but no one's actually got any information. We went to a Plunket meeting, and I'm not getting down on Plunket, but we went to a Plunket meeting for our son last week, and they give us a pamphlet, and this pamphlet was a What Is pamphlet, giving us meal ideas to give to our child. And there wasn't much health in that pamphlet sponsored by What Is. And we wonder why we're sick.
Yeah, the focus is on the wrong thing across the board, isn't it? That's
Absolutely.
one of the big problems that we have. Does
Elliot,
anyone else want to, John, do you want to weigh in there?
I've got some words that ring in my head from Professor Jack Heinemann. And he talks, it's a funny word, but he talks about the imaginary, about what people imagine can be happening with biotechnology. And the industry are well funded, and it's a growing industry, and it's very commercialized. And for me, again, trying to take that, the piggy in the middle consumer who's stuck with these scientists and industry and government saying you've got to have this, and this is going to save us all, and this is going to be great, and the evidence on the other side saying no, it's not, and people are stuck in this middle path. And so for me, the removal in this bill of the regulator to consider risks and benefits of an application, to consider the economic impact that we've been talking about, or animal welfare, or social issues, just to really say this is what's called enabling legislation. It's really just to enable companies to do what they believe they need to do to advance their industry. But science and technology is part of society, and we can't allow them to dictate the future of the world and society. Now, there may be some incremental, and we can argue about this. I have to hope, I have to believe that, there's something good in this research. And the one that I get told by people is, and I say that's why, very contained research and production might be acceptable, but it's outside in the environment, or being forced to take a vaccine that's not acceptable. But the reality is that there may be some small incremental benefits in this. But if you're not looking to see if this really is a benefit, and as Jono says, the farmers have got stuff in the toolbox now. And I keep on thinking about mixed forage, knowing that that diversity of feed does the reduction of the methane now. So if we're not using the solutions now, and we're being promised these non-existent solutions, but they might be down the line with this technology, there's something wrong, because you're not doing what you can do with your tools now. So if you're not using the tools in the toolbox, what does adding something do if you're
And
not
the
using the
science
tool?
is far, also, John, the science is far too selective. There's too much cherry picking. Like, has anyone brought up methanotrophic bacteria that coexist with ruminants. It's literally bacteria that gobble up methane in the atmosphere and feed it back to the plant roots for recycling. Where's that in the, I mean, it's there. There's plenty of literature, but it's not being cherry picked.
Can
So go ahead, Jodie.
Oh, can I speak to the second part of the question, which is what's in it? So just looking at the concept of who's going to win out of this, the biotechnology industry will. And MB have predetermined that many, many organisms will be exempt. Many, many organisms. So this could be 94% of organisms might be exempt. We don't exactly know that because we don't know what proportion of applications from the biotechnology companies are going to be in the exempt category, because that has not been disclosed by MB or Judith Collins. And so the problem with that, and that's why it's so important to have the process base. This is an activity. If it's a gene technology activity, it must come under. And then you have the risk tiering underneath that. If it's never going to be released into the environment, that is a much lower risk perhaps than if it is going to be released into the environment. So they can still do the risk tiering, but the hybrid approach is poppycock, because that we don't know how much biotech are going to gain from all these exempt categories. Members of Parliament do not know that. They've got no idea.
And one of the things that we must be really clear on, we'll never know if this bill goes through, because there's not going to be any applications for them. There's no register of them. It's really exempting them to be left to the companies to do it. So that's a really big problem.
John, you mentioned a thriving biotech commercial industry. Well, I would call it a parasitical industry, really. I mean, it makes money out of speculative investment. It makes money out of government grants. It makes money whenever it's mandated to be used. That's what happened to us during the pandemic. It actually destroyed New Zealand's economy. It's parasitical. What it's looking for is no labeling, so it can simply substitute our common foods with something that they can cheaply produce from grass or some other cheap commodity. Or they're looking for mandates. The government forces its use. That's how this industry works. It's a parasite. And it's a parasite that's growing, and it has to be stopped.
It's kind of a bit like a lottery. So Dr. David Bell has previously talked about, he used to work in the biotech industry, and he's talked about how a lot of smaller biotech startups were genuinely trying to sort of create a product where they might be 7% return on investment, and they might make money over the longer run, and perhaps it might result in something good. But with the COVID pandemic, it showed how a mandate makes a blockbuster. And so that sort of pushed aside, no one wants to be a little guy earning 7% anymore. They want to make blockbusters, blockbusters that are effectively laundered through government policy because people are compelled to accept that medication.
Absolutely.
Thank you. That does lead into a couple of other questions, actually, that I'll skip one of the other categories and go straight to this one for now. It's Nicola B and Elaine M have asked some questions about labelling and some confusion there. So I'll read them both out and you guys can tackle them. So the first one is, where exactly in the gene technology bill does it say that it is overriding the labelling provisions of the Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, the HSNO, and why are there no labelling requirements for genetically modified foods in this bill, and how does that align with consumer rights? So where is it, and why are there no labelling, and how does that align with consumer rights? So I've got John down for you to answer that first, John.
So we have a regime of labelling now, and in fact, I think the minister was saying last year, you're going to continue to label the GMO stuff. Such that labelling is, it's not perfect, but there is it. There is, it is a lot. It does require a large chunk of stuff that hasn't been highly refined to be labelled in the supermarkets. And what the result of that has been that consumers have had a choice and they've chosen not to buy it. And so companies have chosen not to use it because they don't want to have customers not want their products. So most products in New Zealand are non-GMO. And that labelling regime, in theory, is going to continue. These old GMOs, the transgenics, in theory, will continue to be labelled. But the industry is much cleverer than that. So they're going to be replacing all of those new GMO, old GMOs with new GMOs, but they're not going to be called GMOs. They're going to be called gene editing, and they're not going to be labelled, and they're not going to be traced. So that's the sleight of hand. And it happens right at the beginning. And it's actually in the introduction, I think, or what the preamble, or whether they call or the objectives. Right at the beginning, it mentions that the exemption of I think they call them, actually, I can't remember exactly what they call them, but they're talking about gene editing that is often called new breeding techniques in other countries. It's CRISPR and other things like that. The argument is that these make very small changes that are, listen to Guy, please. These make just very small changes that are going to be fine, and they're just like nature. Now, the labelling regime allows people to say, well, I'm not sure I believe that. And it has always done that, at least in the supermarkets. And it could be expanded, the labelling regime that we have. But the point is, to answer your friend, the person's question, they're going to be exempt. They're not going to be labelled. They're not going to be traced. There's not going to be any choice. And I think that's why beef and lamb and the dairy industry are saying, oh, can we have a bit more time on this bill, please? Because traceability and the consumer's right to choose is really something that, you know, all over the world people want, and it has to be in place for this. So that was the first part of the question. What was the second part of the question?
No, so you've talked about where it was in the bill, so you've said that, and you've looked at
So just to be clear, it's not just in this bill. There's other legislation and other bodies that govern what we get to eat. And one of them is called FSANS, Food Standards Australia New Zealand. And people might have heard that last year they started this process. They started to say, oh, look, you know, those things that you used to call GE and GMOs, we're going to call them something else. And we're going to say they're not GMOs, they're going to be something else. Mm. What about a new breeding technique? Something that sounds good. And yes, they've done that, and they're trying to do that in FSANS, so that they're also trying to exempt from labeling and traceability these new products. And just to be clear, I saw something coming out of Britain, and it's English, because the Welsh and the Scottish and the Irish do not want, Northern Irish do not want GMOs, as far as I am aware, and neither do the English, actually. But there is a bill, and I think it's got signed off, and it's called the Precision Breeding Act. And I was really thinking, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. And you know, many people might think it is terrible. At least it exists. And we've got zero in our bill about these products because they've been exempted right up front. The English have got a whole bill about it. And what's interesting about that bill is it asks for kind of things that we've got to have in New Zealand, or absolutely, whatever we're talking about, PBTs, new genomic techniques. They're saying, oh, you've got to apply. So Jody, at least we know how many applications are going in if we had that, but we don't. They've got to apply. They've got to show what the genomic changes are. Now, whether that's going to be robust, and it's some very exciting, you know, we hear from the scientists and from government, you know, the science has moved on. Well, the science of testing and traceability has moved on, and I'm sure Guy will talk about that. You can identify, as we know, you can identify whether it's been gene edited. So testing these things has got much cheaper and easier. So to say we're not going to test them is just an assumption of safety that has no scientific basis. Each event could be different, and you got to check. Our bill says the companies are going to check, and if it does, you know, and it looks like nature, good on them. The British people, sorry, the bill in Britain says, apart from what I've mentioned, they've got to have animal welfare reports, because some very nasty things can be done to animals with gene editing, and you know, simple little changes that don't seem major but are. So they have to have animal welfare reports. None of that in New Zealand. And they've also got to register the product. None of that in New Zealand. So losing traceability, yes, beef and lamb, dairy NZ, Countdown, Fonterra, you know, all of them need to be very concerned. We're about to lose control and traceability of our food supply if this goes through.
And I believe we need to think there's three prongs. The first one is this bill that's going through. The second prong is the FSANS bill that GE Free, PSGR, OANS, I think they've all sent in submissions to it. And then that third prong is the secret trade agreements. And the Food Standards Australia, New Zealand, they have the belief is that 94% of food, this is from a European study, 94% of food would end up not having to be declared. And if you do, if you pretty much do any study anywhere in the world, so I've sort of looked at studies from China and Vietnam and Europe and America and Australia, any study in the world will tell you that the consumer, people will pay a premium for GMO free. So it's really important to realize that 94%, if 94% of food you can't even know, you have no right to informed consent. And the whole point of FSANS is that we have an informed choice for food. So you dovetail all these different pieces of legislation together, and it is pretty much an attack on consumer rights.
What it is a massive expansion of the concept of substantial equivalence. In other words, they're just saying all of this stuff from gene editing, it's going to be substantially equivalent to ordinary things, and therefore it doesn't need to be identified. And the double standards involved here are really frightening. You know, Huntington's disease, one codon out of place among millions in our DNA, and you have a terminal illness. And then they're saying, oh, we're going to change whole genes, not just one little codon, but whole strings of information. And it's a substantially equivalent, and it's going to have the same action. It's a total myth. And they know it's a myth. And I want to say very clearly that what is going on here is deliberate deception. People are trying to fool us because they want to make a lot of money. And in my experience, at my age, I'm quite clear, I'm never going to deal with people who are bent on deception because you can't trust them. And that's the situation we've landed in here. We can't trust what we're being told. We're being manipulated, and we have to oppose this bill.
That leads quite nicely into the next question, Jodie, that I've got your name next to, from Tamara, sorry if I've got that wrong. How can the public trust that there will be proper oversight and accountability for new genetic technologies? And also in the same vein, why is there no liability for anyone if something goes pear-shaped? Who is the bill protecting, and what do they need protection from?
They cannot trust that there's going to be decent oversight, because MBI have ruled the roost, and they've cut out, they've made all these organisms exempt because they're so-called indistinguishable. So even if you use this CRISPR technology, you cut in with your scissors, and you don't even add new DNA, you pull whatever out that you put in, you sort of create this way of the genome, it will reassemble. It's like taking a cup of sand out of a beach, and then that's filled in by lots of different sand. So if we think about the rearrangements, cannot be estimated. And Professor Jack Heinemann does talk about this beautifully. So if we've got all these exemptions that have been lordly, dogmatically excluded, we don't know when that's going to be harmful, or if any of those will be harmful. This is to that organism, but also to off-target organisms. For example, that might predate that, or like honeybees with pollen. Then you've got the other problem, that the technical advisory group is really narrowly, that their powers are really constrained. So the technical advisory group can only look at the notifiable GMOs, the notifiable GE product. So they can't look at the exempt stuff and go, actually, there's a problem with that stuff that's outside. They can't really look at the low risk stuff that's not notifiable. So the tag group are narrowly constrained. Then you've got the Maori advisory group that's their substitute for any treaty of Waitangi principles. So I do urge Maori in particular to look at the text around the treaty in HASNO, and then compare that to the text around the treaty, which constrains what the Maori advisory group can do, and constrains it to them. So that's terrible as well. Then if you look at HASNO, there's principles that are really good, solid principles, because when you make any decision, scientifically, as a regulatory science officer, you have to actually work out, what am I valuing here? And the upstream principles that you can see in HASNO help you value this. So if you then look at what's in this empty, gormless gene technology bill, that's not there. But what they've said is that they've said that the Cartagena Protocol and there's another one, my brain's just skipped now. They are substitutes, but the problem is the officials only have to have regard to these. Now, these might have the precautionary principle inside them, but the officials only have to think about them and then go, I thought about them once. You know, we've heard about that with fluoride, for example. They don't actually have to consider them meaningfully. They don't have to write a report. They can just go, oh, I thought about it, now I've forgotten. So you've got all these things that make this bill so weak, and that the bill produces regulation that ignores all the norms of regulation. So they're not setting in place. A primary act should set in place all these values, all these principles, and really good powers of the regulator. So the regulator can't go and look at international court decisions. The regulator can't look at the peer-reviewed literature independently. And if they want to start looking at something that's been a notifiable organism, guess what? They've got to tell the corporate industry, the industry applicant first. They can't actually start doing a little bit of screening, a little bit of assessment. No, they've got to be totally transparent. So the ball is always in big biotech's court, and the regulator. So therefore, the concept of regulatory capture, this regulator is captured from the start. So it cannot assure us from safety. It cannot be risk proportionate, because if it was risk proportionate, the regulator would have control over not just whether an organism is exempt or low risk, but whether it is high risk. And all of that's been struck out by MB and Judith Collins. So it's very poor.
Thank you.
One of the other things that's missing in the bill, again, there's lots of things that are not in the bill. So it's very hard if you read the bill, say, oh, I can respond to it. But the things that are not in there is ethics. Not one word mention of ethics. No place to go to ethics, no one to talk about ethics or animal welfare, which obviously is related. So that needs to be addressed, because there used to be a bioethics council and it was abolished. And this regulator is not going to have anybody to tell them what is actually good or bad. And as I mentioned earlier, if you look at the MB introductions of what they've done in this bill, they've removed the requirement to think about all these other things like risks and benefits and the economy. The minister, the regulator does not have to assess it. They need to purely take the advice, and not even do that, as we're saying, of these expert panels, and then decide what they want to do, because industry wants that. It really is an enabling regime. And for me, this is all about regulation. And, you know, I really hope Guy's wrong. I really do. I hope that this is not what he sees. But either way, the public is stuck in the middle, because socialized risk is what this is all about. And you mentioned insurance. And I want to talk about insurance. So the deal has been that, because, you know, we wanted to move forward and do a bit of research and all of these things, the risks of GMOs and genetic engineering and gene technology is socialized on the public. There's no strict liability on the companies unless they actually breach the regulators' rules, in which case they get a bit of a fine. Actually.
So you privatize the profits, John.
And so
that's a very nice way of putting it. So it's private profit, but public risk. Yeah. And so one of the things that has balanced that, I'm genuinely trying to find, where's the middle path for New Zealand, where this powerful industry is saying you've got to have it, and the public saying, no, we don't want it. So where's the middle path? So you don't have to have it, maybe. But the industry has got responsibility. Regulation's really important, and to not regulate them is the error of our time, because history shows you've got to regulate industry. They won't do it themselves. They've got too many other drivers to really do it properly. And with genetic engineering and gene editing, as Gaia and Jodie have said, this is very powerful technology. It's piggybacking off nature to recombine the organism's genome again. But one of the things, with that power comes responsibility. So regulation and liability, and I would like to see the insurance industry called in on this debate, because they are experts in calculating risk. And if they can see the risk pattern and say, this is how much the coverage is going to be, then farmers can buy it, or the industry can buy it. But when that's not part of the debate or the process, the public are paying. And it happened before, you know, years ago, there was the PPL sheep. I think I talked about it last time, but thousands of sheep had to be destroyed, experimental G sheep. the company went bankrupt, so the ratepayers and the public had to pay for the cleanup. And that's why ratepayers in Northland, in Hawke's Bay, it's not just free exports and the farmers saying they want protection at the local level, but you know, people are saying, as a ratepayer, mate, I don't want to be stuck with cleaning up that. So cleaning up costs and bonds to clean it up is what the regional and provincial councils like Hawke's Bay, etc., put in place in their regulations, in their plans. That's being taken away. And if somebody asks where that is, there's a line in the bill that removes the power of the RMA and councils to do extra regulation to say, for example.
So it's actually also an attack on local democracy, you could say.
Well, it is, but it's also an attack on local ratepayers. And I'd love to see ACT, which is the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers, you know, they need to speak up because ratepayers are in the firing line. It's not just the farmers and the consumers and the animals and the exporters and the overseas markets, but good old ratepayers.
So speaking of the market, John, I've got a follow-up question from the audience. So Andrew has asked, why has there been no economic or cost benefit analysis presented for this bill?
No time.
No, well,
and I would say they don't know themselves. They don't know how to do that.
They've made all these claims. They've made claims around climate change. They've made claims around health. They've made all these claims where there's been, the data isn't there to support the claims globally. So they can't make that. And the fact that they've never done a cost-benefit analysis to look at, for example, the organic sector, what will happen to them, what will happen to the GMO-free status that our beef and lamb naturally presumes that they have, all of these things are now going to be thrust into the world, up into the air, that is sort of uncertain. So people need to trust. And when people are uncertain, they have a very hard time with trust.
You talked about cleanup before, John. I would say when we're talking about gene editing, it's not as simple as getting out the mop and bucket. Like some of the stuff can't be cleaned up.
Exactly right. Irritability. That's why you need precaution. And just for another, and I might as well fit this in now, but another reason why we need precaution. You know, the Prime Minister in his speech today about the new sector, you know, the growth sector, he's really, really calling up the fact that there is nanotechnology and synthetic biology and AI all converging around genetic engineering too. So the bill is it called the gene technology bill? It needs to be called the new technology bill. And it needs to call out the fact that if you remove precaution and we're going to expand the risk profile of what we do, because it's not just gene editing, it's AI and synthetic biology, etc. You have to have the precautionary principle, or you have to have liability in place. I would say both. And the insurance industry have been very reticent to cover these risks because they can see how complex they are. But that's okay. Complexity, insurance, I'm sure they can manage it. I'm sure. And in fact, there's our records on the Northland Council's got legal advice. And there's a couple of articles about legal liability needs to be in place before you can allow these companies to do it. And again, this bill takes that away, doesn't require it, doesn't allow it, doesn't even think about commercial. This is all about commerce. So commercial insurance needs to be the next thing mentioned, surely.
Yeah.
You referred to it quite correctly, John, as an enabling bill. And you also said that you hope I'm wrong. I just refer you to the last 5 years. I'm not wrong. Look what happened to us. 30 million people died worldwide because of genetic engineering. I'm not wrong about the dangers of this technology. And this is it. They shouldn't use the term regulator, because most things under this bill are getting a free pass. And what the regulator will consider, he should be called a stooge, because his job is clearly to approve projects. That the government actually explicitly states, the purpose of this bill is to let everything go ahead. And therefore, we have to stop it. I'm not wrong. You just have to look at what has just happened to us. If you ignore that, you're ignoring the fundamental fact about genetic engineering. It can kill millions upon millions of people.
And that's why gene editing has to be regulated.
Mm.
And of course,
No. Absolutely no.
Want it to be?
Some of these procedures have to be stopped. This regulation, it's a mirage. He's not a regulator, he's an enabler.
Because I didn't actually know until I spoke with Jack Heineman about that actually there wasn't ever a GE, well, at the current time, there's no GE ban. It's just well regulated.
And the
problem
been
is that no
problem.
one could make it safe enough and effective enough, and so they weren't getting products over the line.
To be honest, there's more than that, Jono. They knew that the public is very reticent about this, and so they've done research. Crop and Food did some research called The Future Urban Consumer, and they asked them, what do you want from the future of agricultural technology? And the least popular was gene editing, and other things like robotics and contained farming and all of those things were appealing, but not gene editing particularly. It was actually the lowest one with appeal. Totally agree, listening to what Guy is saying. I guess I'm thinking, you know, I hear people say, oh, but they make, you know, they make my insulin in a biotech lab, and that's helping me live. So I'm thinking, well, all right. So I don't know the answers, but that's why I want regulation.
And I think moving back to bioethics, during COVID, no bioethics committee was convened. And Collins and Emby have swept aside two important things. They've failed to consider the Royal Commission on Genetic Modification. That 20-year-old document, 10,000 Kiwis responded to that, and it came up with 200 recommendations. And they were very good, very solid recommendations. Now, there's nowhere in the policy process that they've turned around and said, actually, let's have a look at that really important two-year process. Now, as well as that, in a meeting of Collins with the New Zealand EPA, the EPA said their trouble has been because of court cases. Court cases have stopped them from deregulating. This is because judges have found in favour of a precautionary approach and the maintenance of that. Now, the fact that Emby would have the arrogance and hubris to take away, get rid of the Has No Act because court cases made it inconvenient for and difficult for the EPA scientists to actually approve because they had to be precautionary. Can you see how governance is failing when they think they're going to rip, you know, the Has No Act in half and then put something in place because the Has No Act actually was stopping a lot of poor studies going through? So I think, you know, if people really want to start thinking about things, the Royal Commission on Genetic Modification, it's still really relevant, but Emby have ignored it.
I saw someone post up a comment before about the film Percy, or Percy vs. Goliath. If you haven't seen that one, definitely check that one out. It's a really good sort of layman's down-to-earth view of the risks, and it's based on a true story.
Thank you. This is going great, you guys. Just for the audience, we're probably looking to wrap up at about 20 past nine because we've still got a few to go. There's more questions in the chat that we've been pulling out. One that's come up a few times last week and this week as well is expressed by Paul N. He asks, is it true that New Zealand is being bribed or pressured by the USA to relax its GMO stance for freer trade agreements? So would anyone like to weigh in on that?
We know this is locked in. You know, we know this is being put in through the trade agreements. And the recommendation is to listen to the OANZ webinar where Dr. Jessica Hutchings talks about this because she's part of the Maori contingent that can participate in that. So she was really letting us know that there are the biotech steamroller, you know, deregulatory steamroller is there as well, that third arm. Now, the other thing I think is really important to consider is you've got the World Economic Forum, and they're tightly wound with the United Nations. And in the World Economic Forum, there are these top 100 associates and members. So the biotech industry in there, the management consultants in there, and the top banks, they tend to work and they're really the big guys. You've got BlackRock, but then you've also got other major consultancies. They all come together to drive these regulations and legislation. Then you get the management consultancies inside supporting the development of a policy. So, and then you get, they'll be doing the same thing to Australia that they're doing to us. So, for example, Judith Collins goes to Australia, she meets with the other science ministers, but they're being fed the same information and data from all these different streams. So it's the multifactorial nature of power. These guys have power and they're going to use it.
There is something that we can learn. I don't know the details of what's being done. I mean, the fact that MFAT, the Ministry of Foreign Aid, were concerned about our export market shows that they're across it to some degree, because we have got trade deals. But, you know, if you can't sell it anyway because people don't want it, that's a big problem. Mexico, years fighting against, or rather fighting for the protection of their indigenous races of corn. It's the center of diversity for corn. And you know, it's a horrible story if you want to look it up. Years of fighting, and in fact, very strong government scientific bodies fighting on behalf of the public of Mexico to stop the mandatory importation of GM corn from America. And it's been going through the courts, and it just, and they seem to have won. They will win. But at the moment they lost because I think a trade decision was, oh no, Mexico, you've got to take it. So, and it going back to the conversation earlier about, and if you won't take it, then you've got to pay us money, because we're suffering loss that, you know, we can't force you to take it. So that's a possibility that, you know, it has happened there, and it's a possibility it might happen to New Zealand and New Zealand farmers and exporters. And there's a corollary to that, very dodgy, and I hope we have time to talk about that, this mandatory emergency approval of medical if it's been approved in two other countries. The original National Party policy was that that's going to go for everything, other GMO products and GE and biotechnology products in farming. So if Argentina, as I said last week, I think Argentina and Uruguay or whatever said, hey, this is okay, and the regulator decides, oh yeah, they're good guys, we can follow them, we're going to get stuff, we're going to lose sovereignty, we're going to get automatic approval for stuff because the regulator said so, and because these people in foreign countries said so. And that has to be to do with trade. But just one final comment. I was very, not amused, but the United Arab Emirates deal was signed, and there was a bit of people laughing, oh, it was done before they came into power, but the Prime Minister went over to sign it. I looked up what the attitudes of the Middle East and the North African consumer is to genetic engineering. Is not positive. So if you want to export to these countries, we've got to protect our non-GMO, GE-free credentials. And that means traceability of the, certainly, and regulation of these gene-edited products. Otherwise, the consumers in the Middle East and all these places we're getting trade deals won't necessarily want our products.
Yeah, I mean, if you're those consumers overseas and you want cheap stuff, you can get it from a large variety of different places. They come to New Zealand, they source from New Zealand for the premium, for the upgraded products. So if we aren't
just even cheap.
It's trust. It might be cheap. The common, to be honest, I've used this phrase for years. There should be no such thing as a commodity from Aotearoa New Zealand. We've got a brand asset that's been hidden and ignored and not valued. There have been studies. So that the question about the modelling or the economic impact, there was that study commissioned by OANZ that showed, you know, they said, oh, you've got to do more study, guys, because we haven't even had time to do this properly. But it seems to be an estimated 10 to $20 billion added value that will be lost if we can no longer guarantee GMO. Now, those figures can be debated, but I can tell you absolutely the consumers overwhelmingly want gene editing products, not just the old GMOs, labelled and traced, and the markets are not really wanting it at all.
And can I talk about, when I was sort of talking about power, and when we're talking about what the markets are wanting, how there's this massive bifurcation between what consumers want and what power really wants. Can we think about the fact that the select committee, what often happens in the select committee process is they might get 10 or 20,000 submissions. They'll quickly roll through that. Perhaps they're using AI. They'll say, well, we had, 5,000, submissions at the last minute and they were from RCR, so they're all the same thing and blah, blah, blah. And what they don't do is they don't expressly say how many people were for this bill, how many people were against this bill. So what we need to keep in mind that it is the members of parliament who are the front line against all these different interests that are going into, remember, our big agencies. MB is our biggest agency. They're having all the schmoozing with these corporations. I don't know how much schmoozing is going on with the head of the National Party, that, you know, the party whip that tells the ministers what to do, the members of parliament what to do. But we really need to help in the kindest way, most informative way possible, help our members of parliament understand how much will be exempted and how narrowly focused this bill is. And it really controls the regulator to only looking at those notifiable products that might even be just a small proportion of what's going to be edited in future.
Thanks, Jody, for that. It's a really, really important topic. And I know that, John, you mentioned about this mandatory medical activity authorizations. We did speak about that last week. So for those in the call tonight who want to go back and listen to that, you can do that. I have got one question that's sort of along those lines, though, that maybe I've got Guy, your name next to this one. What does the clause on mandatory medical activity authorisations mean for individual rights, and could it violate the New Zealand Bill of Rights?
Just this before is the issue that finish up. This is the issue that the fact checkers are saying, that we've misinterpreted this clause. But if you show this clause to a lawyer, it is basically a carte blanche for the minister. It specifically labels the minister to be able to take decisions about emergency use and mandatory the approval of gene technologies used in two countries overseas is, under this clause, automatic. That means we, as a country, are mandated to adopt medical interventions that are used in any two countries overseas approved by a gene regulator in those countries. The emergency use gives the power to the minister to basically roll out these technologies in way that they see fit. So this is, again, an enabling clause. It enables the minister to take action, and show that clause to any lawyer, and it is worded in such a way that a huge variety of actions can be taken by the minister without any protection.
Which in itself is a huge, that's the Bill of Rights out the window.
Well, since when have we had an effective Bill of Rights? It disappeared in 2020, basically, our Bill of Rights.
It also disappeared in the analysis of the Crown Law, whoever does the report. I came across it as one of the papers for this bill, and they talked about the Bill of Rights, and they said we looked at five or six things and there's no problem in them. But the five or six things that they looked at from the Bill of Rights weren't the ones they needed to look at. So they didn't look at mandatory enforcement of medical treatment, ethnic group rights, anything like that. They just looked at five or six and they said they were fine. I was really surprised. Isn't there some format, Jody, isn't there some format where they have to look at all of them to say, right, nothing there, yes, something there? How can they just miss out the ones that are being breached and say these ones aren't?
And remember, Judith Collins is the Attorney General, and in PSTR submission, we will be talking about the fact that process seems to be jettisoned, whether it's for developing the overall policy or for having particular, important considerations in the bill that would be standard for regulatory practice. So it's impossible.
This is an extraordinary bill. I mean, the comparisons with the enabling bill in Nazi Germany are absolutely rightly taken. You know, it was a very innocuous bill, Hitler's enabling bill. Basically, it switched decisions to a regulator who happened to be, you know, Adolf Hitler. This is completely bypasses the whole concept of our life in New Zealand. That's how I see it.
So it's definitely stuff to fight for as the kind of overall message from this evening, we could go on for so much longer. I know it's already been an hour and a quarter, and we do have to start wrapping things up now. But what you've heard tonight should really help you to give your feedback and go out there and talk to people. This sort of stuff gets turned around by people power. It's you've done it before, and we need to do it again this time. So, use that fire, channel that fire to do something good, to really send a message back to the government that people do not want this for all of these amazing reasons that we've outlined tonight. So you can, when the replay comes out, listen to it again if you need to get these additional kind of reasoning that you can use in your feedback to the government on this. But do make sure that you talk to people out and about this. It's one thing to talk to give feedback to the government. It's really, really important to do this person to person, one person at a time. Having these little chats at the checkout at the supermarket or at the gas station, wherever you are, to let people know about this kind of thing, to use the resources that we've put out there for you, to go and put the poster up, put a flyer on your local notice board, share the clips that will no doubt come from this evening's recording, as well as the ones from last week. And I think we're going to be doing another webinar next Thursday as well, so keep an eye out for that. I'll share with you in a sec again that the Gene Tech Gamble page. And Tane, do you want to? Tane was going to give us a wrap up, but I feel sorry cutting everybody off, but we do have to wrap it up. And I wanted to say thank you all so much for all of your thoughts and opinions and expertise that you've contributed tonight. It's been really, really brilliant. So thank you. To Tane, do you want to give us a
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add
final
on
picture?
and respond to, because you see some people in the chat feeling a bit down about this, but the silver lining is this attack on New Zealand. There's so many different groups and segments of society that are affected, that so many different groups of people are coming together. And I think we really do have a good chance at pushing pause, delaying, maybe even stopping it. They say it's they mark it as progress, but where is it? Where is the destination this is progressing us to? Do we even want to go there? We haven't asked. We haven't been asked. And there's, yeah, like I said, there's so many reasons to be concerned. There's the economic risks, environmental risks, concerns from farmers like Jono. There's the hunting issue that, came up tonight, which we hadn't thought of before. The soil contamination. New Zealand ditching its competitive advantage in trade. And so, yeah, because of this, the many varied reasons, that has brought together a lot of different people. And with numbers, you can apply effective pressure. And that's a big part of what we do with VFF and RCR. We've brought together a lot of people, hoping to educate you with these webinars and provide resources like the poster. And there's more to come on the website. And like Alia said, have those conversations. Put the resources up. One poster could be viewed by hundreds of people if you put it in the right place. So go to the page and get printing, get those out there, and see you on the next webinar.
And it really is something that everyone can get behind. This isn't us versus them. This isn't left or right. This is for everyone.
Help our MPs.
That's right. Yeah, get in touch with them. Send them emails. Make an appointment. Go see them. Talk to them. You. This is how the, be annoying is what you need to be.
That's how politics
When you're
actually
there,
works.
it
Who
is.
actually flexes their muscles and gets involved? So you can be only a smaller percentage of the population, but if you are more active than the, 70 to 80% that literally only care about politics once every 3 years, you can have a big impact.
And if we win this, we'll send a message to the world from New Zealand. And this is winnable. Here in New Zealand, it is winnable.
And don't let people be intimidated, but it's so complex and there's very advanced science and nanotech coming our way and all that. For ordinary people, it is about the right to choose, and that's about to be taken away. So I think even the average parliamentarian can get that's a really, really wrong thing to do.
Yeah, at the end of the day, they all want our votes too, don't they? So if they know that the potential voters are walking away, that does speak. So definitely, you make yourself heard in every way that you can. I'll just quickly show This is the page. Remember, go and check out how to do it. It's not that hard. It's two boxes on a form, and here is all the things to help you in here if that's what you would like. So thank you again to everybody on the panel tonight. Guy, Jono, Jody, John and Tane. Thank you to everybody who has joined in the audience this evening. It was well over 1,000 of you in the audience, which is fantastic. Remember, when you get the alert of when the replay is out, to share that widely in your circles. That would be really helpful for us all. So thank you, and hopefully we'll see some of you next week. And good luck with getting everything out there. Make sure that you go and follow all of these people in their different places. Maybe we could quickly say that. Got Guy at the Hatchard Report. Jono, where can people follow you?
Just Facebook, YouTube, natreformance.co.nz, quorumsense.org.nz.
Thank you. And Jody?
Talking Risk on Substack, PSGRNZ on Substack, or psgr.org.nz. And I often write in the Daily Telegraph, and there's an article coming up in the next couple of days on exactly what I was talking about tonight.
Fabulous. Great. And John?
No, and I'm gfreenewzealand.org.nz. I think it is gfree.org.nz, sorry, for gfree New Zealand. But I'm also on X, and I know a lot of people are not on X anymore for various reasons, but I'm still on there, and I'm at Brand New Zealand. And so if you can follow me on that, please do, on X.
And
everyone should join X.
Can you say that again?
You're a trustee of PSGR, just for...
I meant to mention that. I did put it in something earlier, but I'm not a scientist. That's why, you know, I really do respect when other scientists, or sorry, scientists tell me stuff and from both sides, and I'm stuck in the middle. So that's why I really channel the ordinary consumer going, okay, you're telling me this, you're telling me that. But I have been a trustee for Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility for quite a few years as a kind of layman saying, oh, you guys are really clever. But the average person says, well, I don't want to pay for this, so get some liability insurance. I don't want to have to eat this, so give me some choice. That's where I'm coming from. What do ordinary people know? What do ordinary people know want internationally? Our consumers, and we've got to put them at the heart of what we do.
Your knowledge is encyclopedic, actually. I mean, you bring to this table a vast knowledge on this subject, which is absolutely invaluable.
It would be a disservice to call you a scientist, John.
Yes.
We've been very blessed this evening. Thank you all again, and we'll talk again soon.
Pleasure.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
See everyone.